Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. When we purchase and consume what we believe is necessary for our individual lives, do we obtain what we need? Or do we end up with what the forces of 21st century capitalism tell us we need? In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Benjamin Barber, author of Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, the concepts of dumbing down consumers and the development of brand devotion in the early years of a person's life are explored in depth. I spoke with Benjamin Barber from his home in New York City in early April 2007 and began our conversation by asking him how consumers are targeted in a way that there will never be enough shoppers, and how consumers are infantilized.
Well, what I mean is that the classical formula of capitalism was really a brilliant formula. It said that if you produce goods and services for real needs and real wants, you can both improve the world, create a prosperous society, and make a profit doing it. So you serve others by serving yourself, doing good by doing well, linking together altruism and self-interest. But capitalism in the last 75 or 100 years has succeeded so well in actually meeting and answering real needs and wants that today it finds itself in a position of radical overproduction of goods, far more goods than anyone really needs or wants. So today, capitalism has gone into the business not of manufacturing goods to meet real needs, but of manufacturing needs to sell all the goods that it keeps selling. And in order to sell us all these goods that we don't really need, it dumbs us down, it targets kids, it turns us into 24-hour-a-day shopaholic consumers, and creates a kind of distorted society in which shopping is everything, the market is everything, and nothing else is anything.
Without consideration for what we need or why we need it.
Exactly.
We're taught to need.
We're taught to need because, in fact, as I say, it's a sign of capitalism's success because it's done so well at meeting most of our core needs and wants. But that really distorts capitalism because it means instead of really addressing the real needs of the world, of which there are still plenty around, after all, in the developing world and even here in America, it's making up needs, trying to force them down our throats, get us to buy stuff we don't need, and also trying to turn not just teenagers, but tweens, toddlers, and even infants into shoppers, deploying the discretionary income of their parents. So it's having a really adverse effect on the character of our society, even as it's failing to help capitalism survive.
Well, let's be specific. And you mentioned the conscious corporate manipulation via advertising, marketing, and branding. Can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. Let me give examples that maybe speak directly to the issue of, you know, meeting faux contrived needs here instead of real needs elsewhere. Here in the United States, luckily, we live in a country where from your tap you can get for free all the clean water you need. Our reservoirs and our aqueducts and aquifers, you know, really work very, very well. So in effect, we have access to free water. But we do a business in buying $10 billion a year in bottled water. Now, nobody can show me that there's any need for bottled water when our tap water is perfectly good. Yet here we are spending $10 billion on that, when in the third world, in the developing world, there are literally billions of people who don't have potable water, water even clean enough to wash their clothes in, and who desperately need entrepreneurship and capitalist solutions that can help them find ways to clean their water, get water from beneath the ground, filter their water with the clay that's at their feet, and so forth. But that's not happening. Capitalism isn't addressing that real need, and instead it's selling us boutique water for which there is no need whatsoever.
And it is being sold to the same extent in developing countries without the development of an infrastructure for viaducts and aqueducts.
Well, yeah, and of course they can't afford $2 a bottle. These are people who live on $2 a day, so $2 a bottle of water is not going to do anything to address the problems of the poor. What they need are, for example, and there's some very nice examples around, there are little hand pumps that can be made very inexpensively that can tap groundwater 10 feet below the surface where they live. If they could be brought into manufacturing them, they could actually pump their own water. The clay at their feet can be used to make clay filters or clay cisterns to collect rainwater, another good way to get clean water in parts of the world where it's not naturally available. But again, nobody's gone into business to do that. Nobody's helping them develop their own entrepreneurship. That's what capitalism once did. After all, in the West, in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, in the United States in the 18th and 19th century, we had a lot of needs and not much in the way of assets. And capitalism was terrific at addressing those needs. But it did it by deferring profits, by cherishing hard work, by investing and telling people you put your profits back into things, by creating a ethic, a Protestant ethic of deferred gratification and hard work, all of which not only created a robust capitalism, but a very moral society in which the values of the society were, in effect, supporting the values of capitalism, and the values of capitalism were supporting the values of society. Today, it's just the opposite. Instead of saving, it's all about spending. We have a negative saving rate in this country. People are going bankrupt, paying credit cards and mortgages they can't afford, so they can keep buying, buying, buying. We're telling people, purchase right away, acquire impulsively, be a shopaholic, that's good for you. We're targeting children, not giving them a chance to grow up, but trying to turn them into little customers that spend the discretionary income of their parents. So in every way, this postmodern consumer capitalism seems to be distorting our values and our democracy, and undermining capitalism.
Let's cover some of the points that you're talking about. And I think one of the points there is the encouragement of adult regression into childhood.
Yes, the term I use is infantilization. And the object there is, normal adults do a lot of things. They shop, but they also pray. And they play, and they create art, and they make love, and they have jobs, and they take walks in the park, and they do physical exercise, and they spend time with their families. They do lots of different things. But in this consumer society, basically the marketers want them to do nothing but shopping all the time. And to do that, you in effect want to dumb down adults and turn them back into acquisitive teens who want to impulsively shop, who want to buy stuff they really don't need, take the new iPhone that's coming out from Apple in a month or two. I mean, that's a nice little gadget, but look, we've got phones, we've got TV sets, we have access to the internet. When now we have a gadget that's going to put them all in one place and maybe walk our dog too, for which there's no real need. It's going to cost $400 or $500. It's being heavily marketed. You didn't know you needed it or wanted it until you heard about it. But this is part of an affected attempt to turn adults into grasping teens who just want stuff and whose mantra is gimme, 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 I want, I need, and I want. And that is that's a sad thing for the moral character of our society, but it's also in the long run bad for capitalism.
I don't want to cast you into the role of a naysayer, but you're talking about what Apple is going to do in the future. What do you see that has been done now of the things that many of us have, perhaps you and I included, that we don't really need, that have been sold to us as if we can't live without them?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples, and I'll give you the counterexample of, you know, what's really needed, and how the same firms that are giving us the stuff we don't need, what it could be doing. One that we all know is the fast food industry and the cola industries are feeding our kids and advertising to our kids sugar, salt, and grease goods that are creating an obese nation of teenagers way overweight, when there are people who are desperately hungry for good nutrition all over the world, and even here in this country. We have the odd thing of poor people in America who are both obese and malnourished at the same time, because they're getting all this crap that's really bad for them. Pizza Hut just put out a 2,000-calorie pizza, which doesn't give a lot of nutrition, but makes people fat in a big hurry. 500 calories a day in the third world, and the kind of nut pastes that they're beginning to manufacture there, can save children's lives, but we are putting all this crap, you know, into ourselves. Botox is another great example. Here's the pharmaceutical companies urging us to pump a poison into our face, a paralytic poison, to make us think and feel like we're 20 years younger or 30 years younger than we are, when again in the third world, the pharmaceuticals could be looking for inexpensive retrovirals that would deal with HIV and AIDS at a reasonable price so that people actually could do something about that. We in the United States are buying now 600 thread count sheets, 1,200 thread count sheets that are softer than toffee, while in the third world, one thread count mosquito nets could save millions of lives by preventing malaria and other mosquito-borne diseases. So over and over and over again, you see in the United States goods being manufactured for which, you know, you really can't even exaggerating. You can't really figure out what the need is for when real needs elsewhere in the world are being unmet by capitalism, though once upon a time, capitalism would have made it its business to find ways to meet those needs.
Well, Benjamin Barber, author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, you basically say that the corporations consciously and purposefully engage in infantilization of adults. And I presume you're saying that for their corporate benefit as opposed to anything else.
Well, it's not just corporate benefit. It's the belief that capitalism has to sell unnecessary goods to stay afloat. And that means you've got to get adults to buy stuff they wouldn't normally buy. And the best way to do that is to dumb them down, to turn them into teenagers. Lots of examples of this. If you look at the top grossing movies worldwide, it's not just an American phenomenon, but worldwide, look at what is on the movie screens around the world. The top four films of 2004, and this is the same in 2005 and 2006 and going back quite a few years, the top grossing films worldwide, all audiences, was Shrek 2, Spider-Man 2, the Harry Potter movie of that year, and The Incredibles. Four blockbuster movies designed for 15-year-old boys and girls, but marketed worldwide to dumbed-down consumers all over the world. The New York Times had a piece recently called Pirates, Penguins, and Potboilers Rule the Box Office. Well, in effect, they're saying children's fare rules the adult box office, which means you got to turn adults into children so that they'll consume all that. Same with fast food, sold worldwide. Same with athletic shoes and athletic gear, T-shirts. You know, 40-year-old executives wearing a baseball cap and T-shirts with a brand logo on it. All of that's part of the dumbing down of an audience so you can sell all the stuff that's being overproduced answer what are in no way real needs.
It used to be that people would be paid to wear a sandwich board to advertise something, and now people pay to wear a T-shirt to advertise something.
Great point, exactly. I mean, kids are proud to, in effect, be advertising billboards and to do it for free. You also see kids doing what's called buzz marketing. I write about that in the book, too. Teenagers being paid to pretend spontaneously to enthuse about new products they're given by merchandisers, and they go around saying, oh, have you seen the new iPhone, or have you seen the new this, or you heard the new album? And it sounds like it's so-called peer-to-peer marketing, in which they're merely enthusing spontaneously when, in fact, they're being paid to do just that. We see our athletes with brand logos shaven into their hairdos and so forth. You even see college kids who rent their foreheads for brand logos, and they go around their campuses with brand logos inscribed, tattooed into their foreheads as they go along. So there are lots and lots of examples of this.
Our guest on this edition of Radio Curious is Benjamin Barber, the author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Benjamin Barber, let's talk about privatizing citizens. You relate that into the making of civic schizophrenia.
Well, Barry, the problem is with all of this that in order to sell all these unnecessary goods to reluctant consumers who have been dumbed down or reluctant kids who have been turned into full-time consumers, you really need to detach the marketplace from the oversight of adults, of so-called gatekeepers, and of democratic citizens. It's very clear with gatekeepers. You know, back in the 60s, a lot of conservatives used to say, with some justification, that the nanny state, the social welfare state, came in and took away responsibility from parents for their kids and got in the way of parents being good, responsible parents. But nowadays, it's the market that does that. I went to a marketing convention last year in which there were 1,000 people talking about marketing to kids, and the topic was getting rid of the gatekeepers. And what they said that meant was that every kid has gatekeepers who stand between the kid and the market. Those gatekeepers are parents. They try to protect their children. They try to insulate their children from abuse, from exploitation, and from marketing, particularly as the kids get younger. And the theme of this conference was eliminating the gatekeepers, getting the parents out of the way, leaving their wallets behind so the kids could have access to the discretionary income and become big consumers. And kids all the way down to toddlers today have become a gigantic part of the marketplace. And there are even things like a baby first television for kids, babies from 6 months to 2 years old. We all know about baby Einstein and the attempt to make people buy things to, quote, get smart, so maybe 15 years later they'll get into the college they want to and so on. Marketing not just to adults. You might say, well, adults ought to know better, but this is marketing not just to teens, but to tweens, to toddlers, and to infants. That is absolutely outrageous, but that is about getting around the gatekeepers. But the way we have always traditionally regulated the market and regulated the companies that are trying to sell us things and maybe exploit our kids is through democratic institutions. In the 1930s, we did it to prevent big monopolies and cartels from developing, to prevent the abuse of money on the marketplace. But since the 1980s, we have in effect given up on government, said, as Ronald Reagan did, the problem is government, the solution is the market. So we have, in effect, disempowered ourselves, given away our common power to regulate and direct capitalism in healthy directions, and instead we have watched, in the vanishing of citizens, the market run away with our society and take us in directions nobody really wants to go in.
So how are we going to redirect that?
Well, partly by reasserting ourselves as citizens. You know, one of the devices of the market is to say, hey, don't worry about being a citizen. Use your consumer power. Spend your dollars. Through your use of dollars, you can influence things. That's what real choice is about. Choice is about using your consumer power. But the trouble with consumer power is that it's private power. It's private liberty. It's private choice. I'll give you an example there from the West Coast. You go down to L.A., you can buy or rent any kind of car. There's about 200 brands of automobiles. At Hertz, you can get, they call it their prestige collection, their fun collection, their family collection, all kinds of cars. You can buy or rent almost any kind of car on Earth, and they would say, boy, that gives you a lot of choice. But the one choice buying or renting a car won't give you is the choice for public transportation. Public transportation is something we can only create together as citizens through the use of collective and common democratic power.
The problem with that, Benjamin Barber, is that we are consistently and constantly swamped with the commercial advertising in newspapers, on television, on billboards, wherever we go, that plies in and pries into our minds using the psychological studies created by the corporations that subvert our thinking as to why we should go along with renting a car as opposed to taking public transportation, or many other examples.
Right. Well, by the way, it's not just taking it. There is no public. You have to rent a car or buy one because there is no public transportation in L.A. because we've yielded the public power to do that. But you're right. We are up against a whole series of institutions that make it hard. Traditionally, adult institutions, schools, universities, the church, and government all reinforced wise, prudent, restraint, reinforced regulation of the economy so that the economy served us rather than us serving the economy. But with the privatization, with the attack on democracy, with the attack on government and so forth, we have allowed ourselves to be disempowered. And now, as you rightly say, we face these powerful media forces and advertising and marketing forces that make it hard for us to, as it were, retrieve our power. But I think there is a tendency, and we see it, there are trends in this country that suggest Americans are tired of having their kids targeted, are tired of 24-hour day signage and advertising everywhere they go, pop-up ads on the internet, advertising in the movies, advertising everywhere you look, stores open all day, all night, religious holidays turned into shopping holidays. I mean, there is so much of this. And I want to make clear, I am not arguing against consuming and against shopping. We all have to consume and shop to live. That's the material foundation of our lives. I am arguing against consuming and shopping all the time, 24/7, to the exclusion of anything and everything else. We are diverse, pluralistic creatures, and the ideal human life is one in which you have a mixture of things, of work and play, of recreation and consumption, of praying and creating art and making love and doing all those many things, many of which have nothing to do with shopping. But if we are forced to shop 24 hours a day to keep capitalism afloat because it's not meeting real needs, then not only will capitalism go under, but we will yield our real human ways of living. We will, in effect, become distorted, narrowed, homogenous beings who are nothing but shoppers. And that's not a life I think anyone wants.
It seems to me we're just a brink away from that if the civic infrastructure were to break down. And perhaps from the threats of terrorism, as they've been characterized, if trucks can't run, people will not be able to get the food, which they can no longer grow because they don't know how and don't have the gardens, get the clothing that they need to wear because how to sew is not taught in schools, nor is it taught from parents to children. How do you foresee that possibility?
Well, again, the way we keep a prudent marketplace running in times of crisis is through good, strong social organization and civic organization. Imagine Britain keeping itself going, keeping its markets going during World War II, before the United States entered the war, when, you know, Britain was really isolated. It did that through a strong government, a strong democracy that was able to keep everything organized and afloat. Capitalism is very good at individual wants and needs and at entrepreneurship. It's very bad at social regulation, at social direction, at keeping things going when there's a crisis. That's one of the reasons why New Orleans and Katrina turned out to be such disasters for America, because we, in effect, privatized that disaster. President Bush said, well, you know, let the market deal with it. And the market can't deal with it, hasn't dealt with it. Go down to New Orleans today and you'll see how the market failed. We needed the federal government at that time. We needed our democratic institutions. We didn't really get them. So the best answer to crisis and the threats of terrorism and so on is a well-organized, accountable, transparent, democratic government that belongs to the American people and is used to guarantee that the public goods and public interests of the American people are well represented. And right now, private interests, consumer interests are everywhere represented. The public interest is scarcely visible.
You devote a large portion of the conclusion of your book to two chapters, Resisting Consumerism and Overcoming Civic Schizophrenia. Briefly, how do we do this?
Well, I look at two different tracks, and I try to explore both. One, I ask, can capitalism and can markets self-correct? And my answer is, in part, they can, and I explore various efforts, civic consumerism, the use of consumer boycotts to achieve public goods, as happened with the grape boycott out there when they tried to unionize the grape growers with Chavez and so on. I talk about the use of boycotts in the civil rights movement and so forth. Also, there are among many corporate managers, I don't mean to vilify them at all because they're as much victims as they are perpetrators of the system that we live under. There are many corporations that are looking for ways to be good, responsible companies. And we know Ben & Jerry's ice cream and Paul Newman salad dressings and other companies that work hard, the Body Shop and so forth, that work hard to try to put out decent products but also to use a part of their profits for philanthropy and so forth. And those are also useful measures. I look at so-called culture jamming, the kinds of anarchist anti-advertising efforts to go around and try to undermine a little bit the claims of advertisers and do a kind of counter-advertising against advertising against advertising, you might call it. There's a magazine called Adbusters that does that. So I look at all of the efforts to sort of have capitalism self-correct from within. I also look at some of the efforts to make capitalism work in the third world. I won't go into it here, but there are books by Hernando de Soto about finding the hidden capital in the third world. Muhammad Yunus from Bangladesh, whose Grameen Bank just won the Nobel Prize for microcredit. That's a matter of giving $50 and $100 loans to poor people to get them into small businesses that cure some of the problems right there in their villages and both provide new goods that they really need and jumpstart capitalism and markets in that part of the world. Those are all good ideas. So sort of part one is how can we self-correct capitalism? But ultimately, I argue that capitalism cannot just self-correct. We need the power of democracy. We need the power of citizens making public decisions about the kind of world they want to live in order to really overcome the crisis that has been created. To protect our children, we need democratic regulations. To protect the environment, we need the democratic state regulating industry and so forth. So in the end, we have to reestablish the partnership between capitalism and democracy that, when things go well, has always existed. Whenever there's only state and no market, that's what happened in the Soviet Union, things get out of hand and you get a totalitarian dictatorship. But when there's all market and no state, no democracy, then what you get is either anarchy or cartels or monopoly or capitalism collapsing around its own contradictions. The ideal is a genuine partnership between democracy and capitalism, with markets looking for consumer needs, with markets looking for individualism and competition and entrepreneurship, and with democratic institutions concerned with social justice, with jobs, with oversight, and with regulation, and with directing capitalism in healthy directions. Right now, we live in a society where we are the servants of capitalism, not where capitalism is our servant, which is the way it should be.
Well, Benjamin Barber, author of Consumed, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yeah, the book I've been reading is Doctorow's book, The March, about Sherman's march at the end of the Civil War through the South, which set the terms for the anarchy after the war that led to a wild capitalism. And today we live in an era that is, again, an era of wild capitalism. So I find Doctorow's brilliant description of Sherman's March to the Sea to be not just a terrific read, but also pertinent to the anarchy of our own times.
Benjamin Barber, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Great to talk with you. Thanks.
Benjamin Barber is the author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. Benjamin Barber is a senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society of the City University of New York, the president and founder of the Interdependence Movement, and Walt Whitman Professor of Political Science Emeritus at Rutgers University. The book he recommends is The March by E.L. Doctorow. This interview was recorded on April 9th, 2007. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.